Imagine being shown a two-frame storyboard depicting, in the first drawing, a white police officer having shot a black man holding a cell phone. In the second frame, the officer tells his supervisor that he saw a gun, and that he's sure he'd have fired on a white person who made the same threatening gesture. Then you're asked to make a judgment call. Does this story involve racism? This is the approach that sociologists Betsy Leonderwright and Jesse Strieb take in their book, Is It Racist? Is It Sexist? Why Red and Blue White People Disagree and How to Decide in the Gray Areas. They bring the preceding scenario and others like it to over 120 white Americans of different political stripes, genders, regions, and economic classes. Again, the name of the book, Is It Racist? Is It Sexist? And it's a great pleasure to welcome the co-author of the new book, Betsy Leonderwright, to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A pleasure to have you back on the program.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, Joe.
What brought you to the subject to ultimately look at this and to answer these essential questions?
Well, we noticed something going on. My co-author, Jesse Strieb, and I, we noticed that white people, white voters in particular, were really polarizing on both race and gender issues more than people of any other race or ethnicity. And this was becoming some of the hot-button issues in the red-blue divide. And so many of us like have difficult conversations that are hard to have in our families or our workplaces or on social media or in politics, that we're such on different planets that it's hard to even talk to each other. And so we were curious what was going on. Why was there so much disagreement? Why had things changed so much? And decided to find out not just the things that are easy to find from public polls, like how people vote or what their public opinion poll answers are, but really what's behind their thinking. How do people arrive at such different viewpoints on racism and sexism?
So when you are just studying white people in this, it does allow you to look at inequality because of whites being the largest racial group in the country, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. But because we interviewed half men and half women, we were able to compare people's opinions on sexism, where some of the people we interviewed were more likely to be directly affected by it than others, compared with racism, where whites being the dominant group. So that actually was incredibly interesting to discover that there wasn't a big gender difference in how, there's a little bit of one, but on whether things are sexist or not. The same people who kept not seeing racism in situations also didn't see sexism, regardless of their own gender. So that was fascinating. What I mean there by seeing racism and sexism, we asked them, besides getting to know the 120 interviewees, their life story, we also asked them about 24 questions from current events and from their lives. But also we gave them these fictional storyboard vignettes. And we said, so here's a situation. Is this racist? Or here's a situation, is this sexist? And we found that roughly half of the people that we interviewed all over the North and South East, about half of them tended to always say yes, they saw racism and they saw sexism. Mm. And about half of them tended to always say no, they didn't see a situation as racist or they didn't see it as sexist. So we asked them about a situation where a white police officer shoots an unarmed black person, said, is that racist? We asked about a gender pay inequity based on different number of years in the workforce, from being out with a child. We asked all these questions, and we found that people gave opposite answers. And so then we would ask them, we just didn't ask them the yes or no. We'd say, so why do you think so? What's behind your opinion? And so we were able to come up with how they approached the question. and they approach the questions very differently. And one of the interesting things is that there were some positive aspects to each approach, and there were some problematic parts of the approach that would lead you away from seeing things accurately. We're kind of even-handed that way, and the point of the book is to help people become more accurate in spotting racism and sexism, and more able to work for things to be fairer.
You make the point in the book that the people who were asked the questions often, because there is a divide, they often have argued with their coworkers and their friends and relatives about this, especially around racism.
Yeah, but during the Me Too movement, we were doing these interviews during both Black Lives Matter and the Me Too movement. People were arguing about sexism, too. Yeah, when you think about it, we all get asked to make these judgment calls probably way more often than we're aware of, that people in our family that, like, oh, you know, is grandpa's joke racist or just rude, or at work, in our workplace, is that promotion fair or unfair, or certainly as we decide who to vote for, is this politician a bigot, and on social media, that we're all asked these to make these judgment calls all the time. Do we see racism in a situation? Do we see sexism in a situation? And it's not very common that we think about how do we reach our conclusions.
So with that, how seriously are most people thinking about it? How conscious is it?
Right. So that's a great question. So we found, no surprise, that there was a subset of our interviewees who were conservative, Republican, very political about it. They watched partisan right-wing news or read. They felt part of a tribe, whether they were literally part of the Republican Party or not. So they focused on it a lot, and they're angry at how they think liberals are exaggerating the prevalence of racism and sexism. We were sort of pleased to discover that most of them were not at all hostile to people of color, but they were hostile to liberals. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we had a subset that were very politically liberal. They either were Democrats or to the left of the Democratic Party, and they consumed a lot of, you know, MSNBC and New York Times, NPR kind of media, and tended to live kind of like in some liberal bubbles. And they also were very, very vehement about their opinions, like fierce about how people don't see the racism and sexism that's so prevalent in our society. They're angry about it. And you put those two, you know, far red, far blue groups together, and they're less than half of our 120-something interviewees. Most people don't think about it. Most white people don't think about racism that much and don't think about sexism that much. And some really struggled to even give any definition. We always ask people what their definition of the words, and some people really didn't have one or didn't recognize the issues that we raised in our questions. Some of them have really overwhelming lives, like caring for sick or disabled family members, going through poverty or hardship, and really didn't have the slack to think about the news. And others just kind of had a principled stand. We were surprised to hear the people who prided themselves on being colorblind, like I treat everyone as an individual, very, very proudly. Of course, that means they also don't see color. They don't see racism either. So for some people, it wasn't just they happened to be colorblind, but they were proud to be that way. They think it's wrong to pay attention to people's labels or people's categories and better to treat people as individuals. Things in each group, in each of our subgroups, surprised me, but that one maybe surprised me the most, because so many of those, the people who are like, no, that situation's not racist, and I'm proud to be colorblind. I don't label people. I don't think about what race they are. which I think is problematic because you also don't see the discrimination. So many of them had bigoted parents or grandparents, and they were deliberately trying to be different than the racists in their families. So they would say, yeah, my parents told my sister they'd kick her out of the house if she dated a black guy, but I wouldn't do that with my kids. I say it doesn't matter what color people are. Or, you know, I would never use those slurs that my grandpa used. So they were choosing not to categorize people and trying to be oblivious of people's race and gender identities from a principled perspective of being different than the bigots that they had known growing up. And I don't agree with the definitions of racism and sexism that the people who always said, no, it's not. I disagree with their very, very narrow definitions, where it has to be deliberate, intentional, hostile mistreatment of someone only because of their race or their gender. So given that I disagreed with them, I was surprised how much I ended up respecting them and the ways that they do oppose racism and sexism, and some of their methods, too, that they asked a lot more questions than the liberals did about the scenarios that we put. So that was surprising to me as someone on the liberal end myself.
Betsy Leander Wright is the co-author of the new book, Is It Racist? Is It Sexist? Along with Jesse Strebe. You were talking a moment ago about the generations and what people were doing as opposed to their parents. And one of the things you bring up in the book is that from the 80s, even into the early 2000s, that most white people held very stable views regarding what they considered to be racist and sexist. But then things started to change. Their minds were changed. What was how much was a generation part of that shift?
Yeah, I can't be sure of that based on this study. We only studied middle-aged people between 35 and 59, employed voters, just to make it sort of nice, coherent basis of comparison. But we do know that the gender and race issues became more prominent in the media on both the right and the left, and the two major political parties both picked up gender and race issues as flagship issues in a way that hadn't been true back in the, say, the 90s, that suddenly it became an actual, you know, institutionalized racism became a big part of the platform of the Democratic Party. And the percentage, the number of times that the mainstream media used those words, racism and sexism and things like misogyny and et cetera, it went up vastly over the course of this century that we're in this last 25 years. And similarly, that the denial that racism still exists and resistance for, like, the pushback and banning of diversity, equity, and inclusion programs we're seeing now, it became a major issue of the Republican Party and in the right-wing media. Fox News started highlighting, for example, that the Me Too movement was exaggerating claims or going after men without any evidence. They made a huge cause out of that. And we see that very, very much this right now with the pushback canceling scientific research grants because they're targeted at certain races or ethnicities, canceling arts grants because they're art created by people of color. We're seeing this enormous, enormous rollback of civil rights advances and of the idea of our racial diversity being a positive thing in our society.
You talk in the book about judgment calls. Can you give us a sense of those you spoke to, those voting adults, of what they consider and what you consider to be the judgment calls that they face?
Yeah, let me give an example or two. So here's a simple one, that there's an African-American speaker gives a public presentation, and then afterwards a white audience member tells her, "That was great, you're so articulate." And the presenter thought that the person was implying that most black people are not articulate. And the white woman meant it as a compliment, but later found out that the presenter was offended. So we asked people, do you see racism in the story? Why or why not? So people who said yes to, in most cases, were pretty much immediately said yes, because that's a stereotype, that there's something wrong with how black people speak, if it's unusual, if they're super articulate, and that that happens to African Americans and some other people of color all the time. So they know that pattern exists, and so they say yes. And then, on the other hand, more conservative people have this narrow definition of racism, that it needs to be intentional harm based on somebody's race. And so they're like, no, she's being nice. It says she meant it as a compliment. So, of course, it's not racist. And some of them turned around and said they thought the presenter, the black presenter, was being racist by reading race into a situation where race wasn't mentioned. So that's like an example of how different definitions and different approaches lead to different answers.
So ultimately, as you come away from the work and asking these questions for the book, of where does it bring us in the future, do you think, of where we are? We know we're a divided nation.
Right.
So what do we do with this information?
Well, I think a lot more listening and getting to know what's behind where other people are coming from, understanding each other and not demonizing each other. And then in the last chapter of the book, we recommend something we call the surveyor method of what we think will work to accurately identify racism or sexism and work to reduce it. So there's three parts to the surveyor method, like real land surveyors. You need to learn, you need to scan the big landscape and the geology. You need to learn the patterns of how do these disparities in outcomes come to be. So institutionalized racism and sexism as well as discrimination. But second, you need to probe the local site like surveyors do. You need to gather evidence and investigate, does this case match that big pattern? And sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't. So you put those two sources of evidence together and to form your judgment call. And then the third step is maybe the most important one. You collaborate with other people to build something strong. So you work with others to make the situation fairer in the future. So we think if more people add to their repertoire of how they respond to questions of racism and sexism, to make sure they're doing all three of those steps, that a lot more people could be effective in reducing unfairness in our society than currently happens.
The name of the book, Is It Racist? Is It Sexist? Why Red and Blue White People Disagree and How to Decide in the Gray Areas. The book is by Betsy Leander Wright and Jesse Strieb. It is published by Stanford University Press. Betsy, it's always a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you very much for sharing with us.
I appreciate it so much, Joe.
Be well. Thank you so much. Again, the name of the book, Is It Racist? Is It Sexist? Why Red and Blue White People Disagree and How to Decide in the Gray Areas. Betsy Leander Wright is the co-author along with Jesse Strieb. The book is published by Stanford University Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.